Welcome to the New Book Network's page for Science, Technology, and Society. I'm Patrick Slaney. Today I'm talking to John Cheng about his new book, Astounding Wonder, Imagining Science and Science Fiction in Interwar America. In the book, Cheng uncovers the material and social circumstances that created the social phenomenon of American science fiction. To a population already enamored with the products of scientific research, think here of like the aviation craze, of the enthusiasm for automobiles and for movies, for example, science fiction magazines offered opportunities for exploring science's transformative potential, for reimagining the boundaries of the social and the natural, and importantly, for building communities. Cheng shows how science fiction readers consumed, produced, argued over, and tried to integrate science fiction into their lives. Some were inspired to devote their lives to science, some inspired to write the Science Fiction Internationale. Historiographically sensitive, Cheng argues for detaching popular culture, and fan culture in particular, from a strong identification with consumption, and for the importance of reading texts in their original material context, while at the same time providing a sophisticated reading of the content of science fiction pulps. Cheng shows how stories about robots, aliens, and time travel all reveal Americans' concerns as science became integrated into American society, demonstrating the need for the history of science to be integrated with American history. Hi, John.
Hello.
Welcome to the New Book Network's page for Science, Technology, and Society.
Thank you.
We're here to talk today about your new book, Astounding Wonder, Imagining Science and Science Fiction in Interwar America. But before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am Taiwanese-American immigrant. Came over to the United States when I was very young. Grew up all over the country, but mostly in Portland, Oregon, before I went to college and graduate school. And I've been interested in science and science fiction since I was a child, and only later, when I went to decided to go to graduate school, realized that I was interested in history as well. So the book reflects sort of long-term interests that I've had, I think, since I was very young. I've been an academic, a historian of an American historian, interested in social and cultural history, history of science, and in a number of different areas. So.
So was your undergraduate actually in a science or not?
I started off as a chemistry major. Realized that being a chemistry major meant not just learning chemistry, but working in a laboratory, and that probably wasn't something I wanted to do, spend a lot of time doing. So I wound up majoring in actually a special major, history and science, which was a combination of history, science, and history of science, the three different areas. So I started off in chemistry. I actually wound up writing my senior thesis on the history of artificial intelligence, because among other things I worked, at the time in college, I had a summer job working as a research intern at Tektronix in Portland, Oregon, where I grew up and actually where my parents worked. Actually did a lot of really interesting work in digital signal processing, which I didn't wind up using in necessarily in the book or in my graduate career or professionally, but I've sort of maintained interests in computing and digital affairs since then. A conversation starter is I actually have a patent as a result of those.
Really?
Yes, it's just, you know, it's got a very fancy formal name, but it basically had to do with a way of using digital signal processing to test optical fibers.
Okay.
As I said, it's something I did back in summers in college, and I haven't really gone that road for a very long time. So.
Okay. So where did you go to graduate school?
I went to graduate school at Berkeley.
Okay.
Went there originally thinking I was going to work in history of science, became much more interested in American history generally. And wound up working with two really sort of amazing scholars, John Heilbronn and Lawrence Levine. And I actually asked them when I was working on my dissertation, if I could, because they were both on my committee, if I figured I'd have them both be primary advisors, and they told me I had to choose.
Oh, jeez.
So ultimately, I think I went with Larry because I realized that there were interests outside of history of science in American history that I was in some ways more interested in pursuing. But I've always actually maintained and continue to interest in and continue to read a lot of the literature in history of science. So I would like to consider myself both.
Okay. I mean, I think that there's like this growing recognition that we need to have literatures of national science that are really embedded in national cultures. If you're doing a sort of a national, if you're studying science anyway, the history of science anyway, right? So you said you were like interested in sort of science and science fiction early on, but how did you get into this particular book and this particular project?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. At the time, as I just mentioned, I was trying to choose between the two, and I took a research seminar with Larry Levine, but I had a fellowship from the National Science Foundation at the time, and I was trying to still combine work in both fields, and so picking a research topic, I realized if I worked on science fiction, that was both science and popular culture, the two things that I was most interested in working on. So it was kind of convenient in that sense. The book developed, actually the research paper that I wound up writing, which became the dissertation, which became the book, was sort of the outgrowth of my realizing and looking at the magazines that they were published in originally, because previously when I had read science fiction from the period, it was mostly anthologized, just literally the stories. And when I started looking at the microfilm of the original magazines for this research paper, not only did I see the stories, but I got to look at the covers. And then I saw the advertising. And then I noticed all the letters to the editors that were in the back of the magazines, which I didn't know existed because they aren't usually published in
anthologies.
Anthologies and book reprints of some of the stories. Okay. And the letters themselves became really, in fact, they became as interesting to me as the fiction, because as I said, I was interested in sort of popular conceptions of science, and clearly the readers were fairly invested in that as well as the fiction.
Yeah, and the book is like very heavily based on these pulp magazines and really the material circumstances of them and the dynamics of publishing of them. So, can you say a little bit about just pulps and their distinctiveness?
Sure. The pulps, it's actually interesting because pulps don't exist anymore, it is actually hard for people to sort of imagine them. The best way I find to sort of describe their historical analogy is that you can think of them as a combination of what you might think of a comic book and a paperback book, neither of which existed before World War II, or actually, I guess comic books technically came about at the tail end of the 30s. But they were, in fact, the comic books and paperbacks were an outgrowth, basically eventually replaced pulp magazines. And so if you can imagine them, they were thicker versions of comic books with the cover and the sort of exciting covers and visually visually presented text. But inside, they basically did not have what you would think of as comics, a combination of graphics and text, but just the plain text of what you would find in a book. They would occasionally have illustrations at the very beginning, but other than that, they were all text. And so it's kind of what you think of as a book, as I said, literally a combination of books and comic books, or paperbacks and comic books. They were, you know, they were printed on very coarse paper, called pulp paper, which is why they were called the pulps. They were thought of as having a cheap. They were thought of as cheap, but actually they were not. They were not expensive. They were actually fairly expensive. But then again, also most people did not subscribe to them. They would buy them one issue at a time if they found them, or they found more creative ways to get them without buying them. They were the primary source of, or one of two primary sources of popular fiction. As I said, most people who, you know, mass market paperbacks did not exist at the time. So, you know, you can sort of think of the equivalent of someone picking up a paperback today, fiction to read, they would have turned to pulps for that. Mm-hmm. And the pulps themselves actually replaced an earlier version of the same kind of format you can think of popular fiction, the dime novel, which people have written about. It's interesting that they kind of replaced them because of some peculiarities having to do with marketing and distribution and things like that more than anything else. At least I would argue that.
Yeah. But marketing is actually quite important in the story, right? Of these pulps. Because it's not just that they were, you know, pulps that had science fiction stories in them. They were pulps sort of for everything.
Yes, yes. And in fact, one of the big arguments I have in the book is that the pulps sort of accidentally but still significantly helped create science fiction itself. The literary genre itself, and the broader sort of cultural phenomenon that I describe in the book. I should say technical about it, there's sort of two phases in the history of pulp magazines in the United States. They before World War I, they were all sort of general fiction pulps, this same format, but they basically had a combination of different combined different genres. They were not genre specific. Mm-hmm. After World War I is when they, which is the era that people tend to call the pulp era, when they did specialize in genres, because in some senses they're more memorable for that. But they, as I said, they actually existed beforehand. So, for instance, Tarzan of the Apes, which everybody thinks of as a novel, first appeared in one of the pre-World War I pulps, All Story. Okay. As far as science fiction, what happened was after World War I, given competition from other format, there was another magazine format called the Slicks, which was the term used at the time to distinguish sort of they were the pulps, the Slicks, and these other magazines called that people nicknamed the Qualities. So there were actually three different kinds of magazines. The Qualities were like the Nation. It's probably the best example of that. Harper's. They still exist today. Unlike other magazines, they didn't have very much. They didn't have a lot of illustrations. They didn't have a lot of advertising. So they were in some ways they resembled the pulps. The Slicks were the kinds of magazines that most people think of today, with sort of very lavish covers, a lot of interior illustrations and advertising and things like that. You know, essentially, again, what most people would think of as just a magazine today.
Right.
And so facing competition sort of as the Slick sort of grew and took over more and more of the market for sort of general fiction and nonfiction, the pulps, began to specialize in, specific genres. And in fact, and what I say in the book that it's that specialization and marketing of the magazines themselves that gave rise to the idea, sort of the categories that we sort of think of today as like science fiction, westerns, or detectives. Those specifically in the case of science fiction, they had not been used before, and in some ways the genre is kind of a product of the business marketing sort of perspective of the pulps rather than anything specifically inherent about the genre itself.
Let me ask you a bit about that, because you make this sort of interesting claim about that science fiction is the literary genre that we know arises in these sort of contingent circumstances. But you also you talk about really, I guess, who's one of the main motors behind science fiction pulps, sort of Hugo Gernsback. And the metaphor you use a couple of times when you're talking about him is as a catalyst for science fiction. So I'm just wondering if you can maybe explain what you mean by him as a catalyst and whether and how contingent, I guess, the literary genre is and maybe some ways that it sort of continues to or did then bear the sort of signs of its contingent circumstances that it was created in.
Well, first of all, I think one of the things about science fiction and actually all of these genres that arose out of the pulps is that in some ways they are not formally genres. They are kind of in the sense that we might think of, there's two senses of literary genres. One is in terms of formal literary genres. So like a novel is a formal literary genre, which is very distinct from, say, an epic or, a poem. So the form itself of the narrative or the text is what distinguishes those genre in a literary sense. So in some senses, a lot of the stories that we think of as, that people thought of as science fiction, technically might have been considered novels or novelettes. But there's, genre in the sense of science fiction and westerns, et cetera, is actually not necessarily literary, but is actually sort of a broader cultural category. Because, for instance, science fiction is used to describe everything, many things beyond literature or fiction, movies, for instance, etc. So, part of the point of writing the book and one of the issues that I delve into is what exactly is a kind of a cultural genre? And is science fiction just simply that category, which I think it is. I would argue it is, and I would actually argue that the broader significance of a category that then things get classified under emerges out of the marketing of the pulps. And Hugo Gernsback is responsible for that because he's the person who named science fiction and created the first science fiction magazine. But interestingly, he didn't do both at the same time. He actually created the first science fiction, or what we would call the first science fiction magazine today, a magazine called Amazing Stories. And at the time when he created it, he marketed the fiction within it under the term science fiction, which people used for a couple of years. And you can actually still occasionally see references to it. Fans of the pulp era will refer to STF as opposed to SF. And STF actually stands for science fiction. It's sort of an abbreviated reference. Yeah. He then named science fiction later because he lost control of his first magazine after a couple of years, and he just basically created another one. He called Science Wonder Stories. He couldn't use the term science fiction because it was just amazing, so he coined the term. And that's the term that has come to stick. Now, so that's why he's a catalyst, because he obviously was involved in creating he invented the terms, he invented the magazines. The reason I say that he's a catalyst as opposed to the founder is, I think that he set in motion a number of things that he really didn't anticipate, which I get to later in the book, where there's basically a sort of large, actually it's hard to tell exactly how large, but there's a significant number of readers who had been reading stories of fiction based on science previous to these magazines. And in fact, you know, there are obviously stories that we would now call science fiction that existed before these magazines. But they, the point is that they were not classified or thought of at specifically as belonging to a specific genre.
Okay.
And so part of what goes on is that, what happens is that he creates the impetus so that the term and the category becomes essentially socially established. Enough people know about it and sort of then think, oh, these things that I've seen or that I've read also fall in that same category. And the social sort of part, you know, what leads to that social establishment or the establishment of that cultural category, that the readers, the readers respond essentially to the creation of this magazine, and they sort of again inadvertently, because he needed to fill space in these magazines, he was publishing these letters. He basically published letters to the editors, which was not uncommon among pulp magazines to use as filler, but in the case of science fiction, allowed readers who previously didn't really know other people who had some interest to discover that there were other people that did have these interests, and who they began to communicate with each other, and there were all sorts of developments that came out of that in a way that Gernsback really anticipated. And in fact, the later chapters of the book sort of discuss what the readers did as far as developing what we now think of and call sort of fan culture, which is an important aspect of popular culture, certainly today. I think science fiction is probably one of the earliest examples, and actually probably is, because the language, a lot of the sort of things that fans do in other genres are sort of modeled after the historical precedent of science fiction fans. And so there are many other things that sort of arise. And also another chapter later in the book talks about some of the readers actually pursuing their scientific ambitions and dreams that don't necessarily relate to fiction itself, but is part of a larger popular interest in science in the interwar period that I think is that science fiction basically gives a window into, and that you know, it was another important part of the book that I wanted to sort of delve into. One thing that I sort of want to emphasize is that when I say that science fiction as a genre didn't exist, I certainly don't mean to say that, you know, for instance, Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and stories that people today consider part of science fiction could not themselves, should not be considered science fiction. My point as a historian is simply to say that that's actually kind of anachronistic.
Right.
That when they, you know, originally when they were published, they were considered scientific romances. They obviously were, in some case, you know, known as stories that were associated with science. But they didn't come to be thought of as science fiction until Gernsback set in motion this whole other chain of events. And interestingly, one of the things that that you could actually argue is that for some of the readers in the 20s and the 30s, they didn't realize that Verne and Wells had been published before, because they were republished in some of the interwar pulps. And some of the readers that wrote in thought that they were in fact original publications. So they basically discovered what became what we now think of as science fiction classics through the cultural process that Gernsback set in motion.
Okay. One of the most fascinating things actually in the book is the way that you uncover how science fiction readers and editors really created a quite thoroughgoing community based on sort of the material objects of the pulps initially, and then other forms of zines later on. So can you just say more about that stuff? Because it's pretty fascinating.
Sure. As I said before, you know, when I started this research paper in graduate school, that was the thing that fascinated me the most, was, you know, realizing that the material form of the magazines made a difference in terms of how I would look at it historically. And I knew that science fiction fans existed. If you read enough about science fiction, you'll find out that there is the existence of science fiction fans. I mean, most people are probably most familiar with, I guess, Trekkies, or yeah, as they to be referred to as Trekkers, fans of Star Trek. But I didn't know until I started working on the book that, you know, the history of fandom and conventions went back as far as they did into this period. And essentially that the fan culture was a byproduct, was catalyzed by Gernsback's creation of these magazines. And it has some interesting implications, both in terms of, the difference between consumer culture and commercial culture and popular culture, because in some ways fan culture was all about, to preserve a non-commercial version of the kinds of cultural activities that the readers were into, even though they were doing it through the context of something that was a sort of mass marketed commercial product.
Yeah.
What I discovered, sort of doing research into this, is that there is actually a history of, there is very hard to do historical work on this because the materials are lost. But there's actually a history of essentially what you can think of as amateur press or amateur publications that, in fact, even predates the pulps.
Oh, really?
Yes. I met a collector. Actually, I think he's now donated his collection to the University of Iowa. I'd have to double check, but I did some of my research at the Smithsonian, and they actually had an exhibit on these small hand presses that basically teenage boys, obviously I think probably middle class or sort of, you know, kids with a fair amount of access to money, not necessarily rich, but just not working class, purchased essentially these small hand presses and they printing presses, and they would create their own little pamphlets and booklets in the 1830s, 1840s.
Yeah.
If you want to think of it as a print technology, is not just accessible to commercial publishers, but is the printing and press, you know, you can, as long as you have something that allows you to type or create some sort of, letter form and reproduce it, you know, people themselves can become, you know, can use print technologies for their own purposes. It's just much more difficult to do it by yourself because you have to have both the desire and the resources to do it.
Right.
But that is one of the things that happens is, within science fiction fans. And, you know, it's interesting because one of the reasons that it emerges within science fiction is that, as a newly created genre, Gernsback initially faced a shortage of stories. That was actually one reason he reprinted, Verne and Wells, and also Edgar Allan Poe. On the business end of it, there wasn't necessarily strict adherence to copyright, especially international copyright. So,
right.
Some of these were reprints, but he also, was looking for new material and new writers. So he offered story writing contests in his magazines. He advertised them with cash prizes. And, you know, not only would he get winners, and publish their story, but many of the contestants he could sort of draw on, even if they didn't win the contest, he might offered to buy their stories, etc. So he encouraged the readers to become more than readers, basically. He encouraged them to become writers. And, you know, and whether or not they were good enough or good or not, many of them,
Tried.
Tried.
Yeah. And it's also enforcing, like, the generic the existence of the genre by saying we want this type of story, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. No, it's interesting, after working on this, it's interesting for me to realize that the same principle actually applies to other media. So, for instance, in cable television, this is maybe a little bit of a tangent, but, with the creation of things like the Food Network, that's a channel that essentially is specializes in one particular, in some senses genre. And, when the Food Network first started, they basically have to create their own, they had to find, people that they could have on television. And, even today you can see they have, the next Iron Chef competition. They have the next network star shows. They basically have created content out of their need to create further creators. So it's kind of a parallel to what Gernsback was doing. And it was, in the case of science fiction, it was quite successful. I mean, you could argue that it was probably true for Food Network as well. So there was that encouragement. And then, I think what he didn't anticipate was that the fans would start to create clubs. They would start to correspond with each other because not all of them lived in the same area. And they would then also themselves start to publish their own magazines, which it took a couple of years, but some of them were able to do those. And so that's the origins of what at the time they called fan mags.
Okay.
At the very end of the interwar period, one of the fans, Roscoe Chauvenet, who I actually met when I was doing research.
He's still alive.
He was in the early 1990s.
Okay.
One of the things that's sort of bittersweet about doing the book is I actually got to meet some of the people that I wrote about as they got older, and because the book's taken a while to finish, some of them have died along the way, and it's kind of bittersweet in that way because many of them were extremely generous in letting me basically look at private materials that they had that weren't collected in archives. I really couldn't have written the book without some of the things that they provided me.
To pursue this archival tangent, I mean, the pulps and especially, I guess, the fan mags are really kind of ephemeral. Where have you found them, or were they collected anywhere?
The collectors are the fans.
Okay.
Although things have changed a little bit. When I was doing the research, when I first began doing the research, they were not collected in archives. And so basically I reached out to fans, fan networks, and asked people if I could visit their homes and to see their collections. This man by the name of Bill Blackbeard, who basically ran something called the Science Fiction Academy of Comic Art. He collected comics and actually many things besides pulps. He allowed me, basically I went to his house, or in his garage and spent, a week going through, the materials he had. The magazines themselves were available on microfilm. But the fan magazines, yes. So, I went and interviewed some of the, as I said, I met with some of the fans and collectors. One treasure trove that I just sort of discovered, I sent letters to a bunch of people through an organization called First Fandom, which they call themselves the dinosaurs of science fiction. They are literally an organization of people who were involved in science fiction before 1939.
Yeah.
So exactly my time period. I mean, you can imagine how thrilled I was to find out there was this organization. So I wrote them and I asked them if they had any of their correspondence. And most of them told me I was crazy because nobody kept letters of that. But I actually found one person who I have to look up his name, Mr. Yerke, who got a graduate degree in library science and not only collected everything, but
archived it properly.
Yes, he had them all filed away.
Wow.
And then not only that, he, of all places, Bruce Yerke. Yes. Of all things, he lived up the street from where I did, from where I was living in graduate school. So I, you know, when I wrote to him, he said, well, actually, I'm just up the street. You know, and I went and visited him, and he was gracious. He just handed me this entire file and all of his correspondence, and I was ecstatic. There are parts of several chapters that couldn't have been of one chapter that couldn't have been written, I think, without some of the material that he gave me.
That is very lucky. It's great.
Yes, it is. Things have changed because Blackbeard's collection is, I think, he donated it to Ohio State.
Okay.
The Mike Horvath's collection on amateur press, I think he donated to the University of Iowa.
Okay.
One of the biggest collectors, some people refer to him as the first fan, was the man by the name of Forrest Ackerman. I corresponded with him, and I was trying to arrange for him to visit his collection because he had arguably the largest collection of science fiction for ephemera anywhere. He was in the process of negotiating to try to donate them to an archive. And so I wasn't able to look at them. Look at this stuff. There are some collections of science fiction materials at the University of California, Riverside. There's one in Australia that a friend of mine worked on. So university archives are beginning to collect them now. But it's something that's changed as people have begun to sort of look at this not as essentially garbage and trash, but actually as material that might have historical significance. If we want to get over sort of the kinds of class sort of based
right. Prejudices.
That people at the time had.
Yeah. So you've uncovered this like really dynamic community that's sort of productive, that's generating itself, that's interested in science fiction for non-commercial purposes. I guess, what are people getting out of science fiction at the time? And what do they hope for? And I guess, what are the broader implications for the way that they were imagining science in the interwar period?
Well, I'd say there's several different answers to that. Because, you know, at the moment, in this period that I'm writing about, people are clearly as interested in the science as they are in the science fiction. The science fiction fandom and the science fiction sort of portion of it grows out of the, again, in some ways unanticipated response to science fiction as a kind of cultural phenomenon, not just the magazines, which at the time, actually, I should say, they were moderately successful in the interwar period. They were initially tremendously successful in the mid into the late 20s. Obviously, when the Depression hit, the circumstances changed so that the magazines themselves were not as successful.
Was that pulps in general, or was that science fiction pulps in particular that suffered?
I think it was pulps. It's actually hard to say, because one of the things that I discovered I realized in doing some of the research was that the readers, as I said, the readers didn't necessarily buy pulps. And so because they were sold, they were not necessarily sold by subscription, it's very difficult to get concrete numbers in terms of the actual readership, the actual numbers of copies that were sold. So the publishers in the 30s said that it was grown tremendously. In the case of Gernsback, he actually wound up, the second magazine, Science Winter Stories, wound up folding in the mid-30s. It got picked up by another publishing house. So there, you know, pulps in general sort of did continue to, they obviously flourished enough to, through the 30s that they didn't go out of business. Gernsback did go out of business, but by the time he did, another chain, Street & Smith, who was sort of a longtime publisher of dime novels, had created another title called Astounding, which then sort of in the early and into the late 30s became sort of the flagship sort of, science fiction magazine, both in the views of the, writers, because they paid
the best.
And they paid them, and they paid them consistently. And also in terms of the fans. By the end of the period, one of the fans who became an editor of Astounding, John Campbell, he's generally considered sort of the editor responsible for inaugurating something called the Golden Age of Science Fiction. He's the one who first published Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, other people who became not only popular among science fiction readers, but generally popular within sort of American popular culture.
Right.
Essentially, science fiction is moderately successful, but it's kind of a niche genre in the 20s and the 30s. It becomes much larger after the war. But in the time in which it's that niche genre, the fans who are very active, are able to, do all these things that lead to, as I said, you know, this fan culture, which then is essentially positioned, very extremely well for the expansion of science fiction into sort of popular culture, publishing, and everything afterwards. So it's one of the, sort of, in some ways, it's a question. It's an issue of historical timing, basically. That science fiction didn't take off as quickly as it did, allowing the fans to essentially, you know, develop a larger place within the cultural phenomenon. So, what does it mean for them? If I can sort of get a little bit sort of, in some sense, it's a little bit grandiose, but in a way, I think one of the reasons that, one of the things that I wanted to get at in this book is that, the book is kind of I view it as kind of a response to, works in cultural history that basically, for lack of a better term, substitute popular culture for mass culture, basically only look at the work of producers. I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind about culture is that it's motivated, you know, that there are important social and psychological, emotional sort of reasons for people to engage in cultural activity. So, you know, why do people read? Why do people? Those are large questions that really can't be answered, but it's important if we're going to write about cultural history, not to just simply say, well, you know, take the perspective of the producers and say, okay, this is what's going on. So it's clear to me that looking at the fans, that there is an aspect, you know, and again, this is in some ways, it's not clear if, and I wouldn't want to sort of overgeneralize this to, historically, but it is clear that the fact that this is occurring in the middle of the Depression, when there's a lot of question, not only is there, economic turmoil, but there's a lot of questions essentially about capitalism, about communities, about where, sort of the social fabric of society is going. The fact that science fiction readers have something that they can, and I would extend this to popular culture in general. Have something that they can participate in, and you know, essentially bring meaning into their lives. I think that's not to be underestimated, and I think that there's an anti-commercial aspect that arises within fans at the time that's a product of the Depression era that today sort of doesn't necessarily, you know, that anti-commercial sentiment isn't as prevalent among fans. In some, you know, the fans who just simply distinguish themselves as amateurs versus professionals. But it clearly has larger implications about class culture and about class sort of conception that I couldn't really delve into in the book. But, you know, what is it? I mean, if we think of work as something that we do productively, what does it say about, you know, the kind of society that we live in, that people will work in the sense of having a job, but in order to support their real sort of interest in something that is outside of work, and that they actually spend a huge amount of money and effort in, and still want to preserve its kind of amateur status. That's one of the really interesting things about fan culture that I think, you know, that I couldn't really address in the book, that really needs to be teased out. You know, as far one other thing about the period I think is less prevalent, was that science fiction really was an avenue for people who were interested in science to try to express themselves. And, you know, that's an important part of the book, because, you know, one of the contexts that I wanted to bring out was that that not as many people finishing high school, much less attending college. And so, you know, this is really an era where clearly science is in the air, in the same way in which, for instance, the internet, you know, electronic, sort of the potential for electronic and digital sort of production is in the air today. And there's a lot of uncertainty about where it's going to go, but people are obviously familiar that things are changing. That there's a kind of parallel to that, you know, as far as science, which, by the way, in the interwar period refers to both science and technology.
Right.
Because technology is a term that's not actually used. And so the two are used synonymously. But, you know, if you imagine in the 1920s, you know, it's the airplane, the radio, those have just literally only existed for 20 years.
Right.
And so it seems a little bit far-fetched now, looking back, to say, well, you know, people are going to build rockets and go to the moon. But in the context of realizing that, you know, 20 years before, people had never been to fly.
Right.
And literally you went from the Wright Brothers Flyer, you know, a sort of very flimsy plane, to DC-3s, commercial aircraft, commercial transport, much less, you know, people were, this is before Hindenburg, there were Zeppelins, there were all sorts of things that were happening. And people, even if they weren't educated or formally involved in it, which the majority of people were not, this was something that many people were engaged in and wanted to know about. So, for instance, you know, there was a screening of a documentary film of about Einstein's theory of relativity at the American Museum of Natural History in New York that actually caused a riot.
Right.
I can imagine, right? That there were a riot would break out over what happened. So, science fiction, I think, in the era, regardless of what you might think of the quality of fiction, et cetera, this was a way that allowed essentially ordinary Americans, and some of whom later actually, because they read science fiction, they were interested in science technology, then in, you know, produced and things that would be significant, that are significant. But was a way that people became were allowed to become involved. For some of them, it was simply about demonstrating their knowledge of science. But again, in an era not as many people were as educated, the idea that you would essentially be self-educated, that you would have knowledge that was not essentially demonstrated by your educational attainment, your credentials, but literally by what you were through, show people. That was an important aspect of the letters that people were writing. Some of the fans were writing because they wanted to share their enthusiasm and then demonstrate their ability in science.
I mean, we've talked a lot about the community that developed around science fiction and about pulp and around pulps, but your book also has a lot to say about, I guess, the content of the pulps and the kinds of stories and the themes that they were addressing. And we should talk about that too. So I guess I want to ask about gender and robots and domesticity, because that's one of the themes that you pull apart in one of the chapters. And you kind of include this great quote by Isaac Asimov, writing to Astounding in 1938, where, you know, it doesn't seem like he wants gender or domesticity to have its place in science fiction stories. He writes, when we want science fiction, we don't want swooning dames, and that goes double. Come on, men, make yourself heard in favor of less love mixed in with our science. So what's going on here?
Well, one of the things that there's a lot going on in there. That's the short answer. As much as the book is about, a lot of the book is, the structure of the book is about essentially providing context, for lack of a better term, an ethnographic perspective on these communities. You know, what the stories conveyed, and actually, I should say, step back and say, not just the stories, but the conversations that the readers themselves were having in terms of the letters. The middle part of the book was the result of my thinking about how do we talk about literature historically and read it sort of in cultural context, because, you know, if we just simply read the stories, we might get a different impression than, you know, if we actually looked at some of the letters that readers were writing, as a result of reading the stories. Sorry, it's a little bit confusing. In examining the stories, the middle part of the book is called reading. But it's not just, as I said, it's not just about reading the stories, but reading the larger historical themes that come out of this. And so, one of the things that I began to realize is that some of the motifs that we associate with science fiction specifically, like robots, like aliens, another chapter in that section, are not ahistorical, that they are, in fact, the specific result of historical context that are, in some senses, lost, and that I try to recreate in this section of the book. And so the chapter about gender and domestic tranquility is basically it's a very complicated chapter, but it basically began as a way of figuring out to explain the fact that so many of the readers were bringing up gender in the context of science fiction. What's the larger, what are the larger implications of that? One of the side effects of that, I argue, is that it turns robots into machines. And so it's kind of an interesting twist on the notion of the science fiction robot. The term robot comes originally from a Carol Coppock play called RUR, short for Rossum's Universal Robots. And in the play, robots are created. They're not born, but they're actually biological. And not only that, but they are male and female robots, and which is an important part of the play. I don't want to go too much into it. Somewhere along the way within science fiction, however, robots essentially become machines. And so in thinking about how this sort of came about, I realized that it actually, the love letters and the sort of arguments about gender actually help explain that. Because essentially, by removing gender from robots and turning them into machines, it allows the science fiction and sort of the readers to essentially remove gender from a concern and replace it with machines, first of all, associated with, obviously, with the technological, the machine era of the time. But also for them to, and essentially what I realized was that the gender was at play, because the men who were actually saying that we need to get rid of love in science fiction were really saying that they wanted to reserve it for their own sense of masculine worth, so that they could demonstrate their scientific ability, which is what I was kind of talking about before, which the women then sort of responded by saying, well, women also have scientific ability too. So there, you know, love essentially represented a lot more than, of what was going on than I think in some ways the teenage, I should say, you know, Isaac Asimov, when he was writing, was a teenager, so we can't necessarily sort of hold him accountable for the sentiments. But, obviously those things are going on. And I think that, it has larger implications for science fiction generally, because one of the things that I wanted to sort of point out from a historical perspective, and I don't necessarily mean this in a critical perspective, is that there's a certain irony to the fact that Gernsback is encouraging this huge social community to embrace science fiction and to develop science actively. In other words, he's trying to encourage sort of agency among the readers, and to see, to give them a place, to encourage them to see themselves as having a place within science. This notion of science that is emerging at the same time, out of other circumstances beyond necessarily science fiction, was encouraging people to think of science as something that was objective, that even though it was done by people, is sort of outside the authority of science, exists outside of society. So that a lot of the celebration of science that goes on in science fiction, and particularly in the science fiction era, becomes naturalized. So this odd way in which the agency gets of readers gets directed into the fiction and not necessarily into themselves, and if you sort of look at the plots of some of the stories, the robots essentially represent a kind of labor threat, and they become essentially menaces. So that that masculine heroes that Asimov didn't seem to have an objection to, it was actually their masculine virtue that was the flip side of the romantic love that the female characters in fiction had. And by the way, neither of them, neither male nor female characters were particularly developed. That wasn't essentially the point of the stories. Which is, again, something that the male readers didn't necessarily pick up on. But as I said, so the robots represent this threat, and in a way, the heroes, defeating the robots allowed themselves to prove their own worth, which resonated with a lot of the readers, wanting to participate and be a part and have some sort of control over, the fact that science was changing society. Mm-hmm. Right. But in a way, that's, you know, that kind of process is psychological. And the net result of sort of what happens in the sort of within science fiction is the science triumphs in terms of producing progress. The human characters triumph in terms of their social virtues, but in a way the two become sort of divorced, so that right. So science becomes natural and not social.
Right.
It's kind of interesting, and you know, you could the last chapter I have in that section sort of follows up on that point by looking at time travel. And basically the fact that, you know, in order that time travel in this particular period doesn't always goes forward before it backward, so it doesn't trouble the past.
Right.
You know, which is interesting because it allows people to continue to imagine the idea of progress,
right,
but not to imagine the implications of what happens if you go into the past. If you change the past, then you change the present, and you can essentially unsettle it. In a way that actually that science fiction after the interwar period actually, you know, I mean, that's in some senses the dominant motif and continues to be today. People want to look at alternative timelines.
Right.
You know, that people essentially kind of want that uncertainty. Because what that allows you to think about is actually, you know, human and historical agency.
Right.
Ironically, the time travel did not, you know, it allowed you to imagine, but it didn't allow you to achieve. And so it is an interesting dynamic within that. And it's important for me. It's important to point that out, but then also to point out that, you know, that dichotomy doesn't necessarily then play out in terms of the readers, because whether or not they recognize that there is that dynamic within science fiction,
mm-hmm.
they, you know, do all the things that I was talking about in as far as fan activities, and you know, after the book, they actually go on and build rockets.
Right.
And they, you know, discover in a different way, in a real historical context, that history, you know, is not rehearsed. That you do, you know, decisions that you make have consequences. They realize that the actual process of working on science, doing science, exists in a social context and, you know, exists in terms of thinking about prestige, public media presentation, authority, and, you know, things as well as actual concrete experimental results, and I sort of went into that in the last chapter, because, you know, basically they discovered that in order to become taken more seriously in their scientific work, they have to, in some senses, disavow and that, I mean, without going too overboard on that, I think that that is an important separation that I hope would be recognized without being controversial.
Yeah.
But science is, in fact, the disavowal of that, you know, of very important. And I think in some senses that kind of puts a artificial blinder into science. That we traditionally think of the history of science as the history of scientists, scientific work. This is not the case across the board, but you know, it's not very. Scientists don't necessarily talk about the more respectable things that they do sometimes in some regards. And, you know, particularly if you look at the history of NASA, aerospace engineering, the sum total of everything that's going on and why people are doing things, I think there's a more interesting full picture that still doesn't come out you know, people tend to look at professional aspects of things. You know, the Wernher von Braun is well known as a rocket scientist. And there are, but I mean, the things that not a lot of people know unless they happen to be historians of aerospace is that some of his most important papers, you know, like actually one important, paper that he wrote that's actually an appendix to a novel about a trip to Mars.
Okay.
It begins actually with Robert Goddard, who published, you know, one of his treatises. Actually, one of his most famous papers, most popular for a small part of what he sort of wrote about, where he basically imagined, you know, had a thought experiment where he launched a rocket at the moon, and if it contained enough explosive power, if it hit the moon, you'd be able to see it on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's his rockets, but it's the one thing that he picked up. He read War of the Worlds every year, I think, as an annual ritual for his, if we look at the history of science today, I think it would be, I mean, with integrating sort of the scientific work that scientists do, I think it's really important that we have a fuller picture of what is involved. This is much more difficult and broad issue, but I think what the point is, you know, in history of science, how do we think historically about popular science, even if the science is in some senses incorrect,
yeah,
or but still, and is not professionals, but it still has and I sort of hope that the book will open up sort of discussions about it, but at larger.
Okay. There's so much in there, and there's like so much more to think about, I think, John. What are you working on now?
I am working, I'm doing some follow-up on the book. Some of the stuff I discuss in the epilogue about realizing that essentially when I began writing the book, I described as communities that they're really social networks. You know, use the sort of a fashionable term, but that is actually the most appropriate term. that in some ways the stuff that I write about in the book is a historical precedent for some of the concerns that we have today about electronic media, about social networks using, again, sort of information technology and digital media. And so I'm working on a couple small things that basically draw out the connections to basically say, you know, this is an example using print technology of the same sort of social issues. Basically, to say that social networks existed before technology, digital technology, it just worked, you know, at speed in different ways, possibly. But the larger issue of the sociability is not inherent to digital technology, but to just technology and its place within society. I'm trying to put together an online. The database that I used, that I put together for the book, I'm trying to put that online, including the letters to the editor. And I'd like to, I've set it up as a wiki, and I'd like to, at some point, get it advanced enough so that I can tell people, you know, look, if you want to be a part of this, it would be great if people want to, help me track down some of the, biographical information about some of the readers.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for a number of the fans that I, and writers and readers that I looked at. But I read over 4,000 letters to the editors.
Wow.
A lot of people signed their names and provided their addresses.
Right.
I am trying to sort of put that all into a database so that you can then sort of map and see, you know, where people were writing from, you know, how many people came from different states, how many people came, essentially map geographically, and also to map out, literally map out the kind of social networks that they become, their evidence of. And I want to sort of look at that. So I'm going to sort of write up, I think I'd like to write some follow-up pieces to sort of highlight that aspect of the community in a way. You know, I wasn't able to do working on the book, but is now available using sort of databases and stuff like that that are available. So I'm following up on some things from the research that I didn't do in the book. I'm also started a second project that I have actually kept on the shelf for a very long time. It's an outgrowth of the one. In some ways, it's an outgrowth of the one chapter in the book about aliens. Mm-hmm. Talked about this, but the connection between aliens and Asians.
Right.
And issues of race.
Right.
Which I think is actually, you know, is very, very rich. There's a way in which race, you know, which is essentially an expression of fundamental human social difference, gets mapped onto aliens as a fundamental natural difference. And, you know, those issues and the sort of the relationship between the two continue to be sort of to express, you know, read about this, but there was a recent sort of brouhaha about the fact that the film version of The Hunger Games.
Right. One of the characters was black or something, right?
Several of the readers of the original novel didn't notice that they were described having the book, you know, but then they reacted to the fact that suddenly confronted with the character black, and you know, that they sort of into it, and you know, and you wonder, well, in science fiction where you're imagining a future, now it worked the same way it does. So, but we're still obviously bringing it into our imagining, you know.
Right.
It's in our imagination. So I'm got another project called that I'm tentatively calling Barred Zones, which is basically a work in Asian American history, history of Asian Americans, and sort of looking at the legislative history of sort of that's buried within various acts of Congress and cases, but really has sort of larger, and specifically is about Asians and Asian Americans. It's called Barred Zones because after this thing called the Asiatic Barred Zone that was created by Congress in the 1917 Immigration Bill, which I encountered in the historical literature, aimed at anti-immigration. One of the first attempts to limit immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe, which it did. But a small portion of it actually, for the first time, defined a geographic area, Asia, basically excluded people from that area from entering the United States. And, you know, because it was enacted by Congress, then the Supreme Court has to decide what the implications are for that.
Right.
So this got me thinking about the relationship of race and sort of nationality to concepts of geography. Because literally, this, I mean, you know, and literally, like, what does Asia mean? And the project sort of looks at the history of geography, specifically the idea of continent.
Okay.
Is an artificial construct.
Right.
You wanted to think of it geographically, there's Eurasia.
Right.
Even some people argue that the idea of continents is kind of is meaningful, is geographic, but in some ways it's not because it's artificial.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily reflect, for instance, physical geography, which doesn't like that do.
It's about a racial geography.
It's essentially it's about it's a geographic concept that then becomes used as something that's natural.
Right.
I think in Astounding Wonder about what is social, what is natural, and what is the distinction between the two of them. That's what I'm working on now.
Oh, okay. Sounds fascinating. I'm looking forward to reading it. Thanks very much, John.
Thanks. You too.
You're welcome. That was my conversation with John Chang about his new book, Astounding Wonder. There's a lot in the book that we didn't get to talk about, and I think the book will reward careful reading. In particular, his arguments about race and aliens, about truth and facticity, and about time travel and progress will help us understand the cultural dynamics of interwar science. It's a great book. You should give it a read. The New Book Network Science, Technology, and Society page. I'm Patrick Slaney.